story. So listen, I'm honored to be here to share this moment with all of you. And again, I've met a lot of inspiring people that are doing a lot of amazing things. I think that at a conference like South by Southwest, we see many people that have these new innovative ideas in regards to how we're going to look at how things can change the world, potentially. You might not know it now. You might not even think it now, but it's starting. And again, when people start to use your platform, all of a sudden they'll find ways and be innovative about how they actually use it, not just for that's going to help your own audience, but also how it actually helps other people. So with that, we started looking at all these different technological platforms that were coming out and how people were using it. And what was really inspiring is that a lot of people started using things around social change. And what was important, particularly for myself, is I started looking at the issue around content and what defines content and how are we looking at content. I think everybody, when here, looks at the word content, and it's like, well, what is that? Is that a video? Is it a story? Is it a tweet? Is it a Facebook post? Is it a photo? Now it's Pinterest and it's Tumblr blogs, and people are just expanding what that means. What is content? How are we consuming that? And what's interesting about that is that you have people are consuming much more of it online. It's sort of, in a way, defining who we are. It's like what I remember using Napster for the first time in the late 90s, and what compelled me wasn't just about the actual files that I was getting, it was the individual of who I was getting them from. And I think that sort of, that connection, that real connection that I wanted to make with other people, it was really important to me, and it was really important to how I was consuming content online. And, when AOL and the Huffington Post came together about a year ago, Arianna Huffington asked me to continue to come over and help build out these content verticals that were around social change and around inspiring stories and how we could activate people when they were inspired and what different things, different actions people can do. Because it was at that point when people are motivated to do something and to learn something, we felt that there's now the next step and there's a new opportunity of how they can get involved. So now you have people just throwing content out there. You're like, here's I'm going to share it on Facebook. I'm going to tweet it out. I'm going to post here. And all of a sudden, there's this mass volume of content that's just getting out there. So what's the next step? How are we dealing with this rise of this volume? And that's sort of now we have individuals become more curators. They become more their own aggregators. I think that was the great model that we have at the Huffington Post is that the individual editor becomes that person doing that for you. And I think Twitter is a good example of somebody that's out there helping do that as well. My story starts with me being a 9/11 volunteer and being on the ground. I heard and saw so many things that were inspiring to me. This, like, one story in particular was after the third day being down there, there was a group of 20 firefighters from Chicago, and they came directly from Chicago in order to find their brothers. And I was just so compelled and so taken with that story. I was like, this is 2001. How do more people know about this? How do more people know about what individual people are doing out there in order for them to be inspired and they can actually go out there and be that change? I tell people all the time, one of the stories that I heard that got me coming, the last time I was at South by Southwest, I was a president of a record company. I was in the music industry working with my partners with a rock band, Korn. I had a little bit longer hair, drank a little bit more, or maybe I should drink a little bit more tonight. But and really it became about, this way that be able to highlight those individual stories and that people can actually then share. And that story made me move to be in the space around philanthropy when I heard Scott Harrison's story. And he was a nightclub promoter. And then he went to, took a trip around Africa, and he took photos with Mercy Corps, and that started the idea around Charity Water. And I was like, if that guy could do it, well, I think I could do something like that. So, and that started it, and today it's changed my life after hearing someone like Scott and his journey. So today I wanted to introduce a person who helped shape the way that we send and receive content that would change social media and social impact landscape forever. And it actually started here, right here, South by Southwest in 2007. And that's why when we talk about content as a means for social change, this story that you're about to hear from the next, with my presenter that I'm about to introduce is going to tell that. So as a proprietor in the early social web, Biz Stone became an internet entrepreneur in 1999 and went on to go work for Google. And later, Biz co-founded Twitter, which launched in 2006 and was, I think people started to catch on, I think, right here in 2007. We're at South by Southwest that we're about to hear. In June of 2011, with his longtime collaborators, Evan Williams and Jason Goldman, Biz co-founded the Obvious Corporation to focus on building systems that help people work together to improve the world. As a fellow of Oxford University, Biz had debated at Oxford Union and won on the subject of whether or not entrepreneurs can affect positive change with regard to the world's biggest problems. An adamant believer that when we help others, we help ourselves. Biz supports a new way of doing business with a higher level of ambition and a better, more altruistic way to measure success. Beyond immediate needs, Biz advocates selflessness, insisting we follow this path in order to deliver deeper meaning in our work, and in doing so, place value before profit, which I think is very important for all you inspiring innovators and entrepreneurs out here today, that gets built into what you are doing. And that's why we're giving this talk today, to make sure that gets ingrained. You take something away with that when you go and leave this room and change the world. In his role as a social impact advisor to AOL Huffington Post, Biz counsels myself, Ariane, and the leadership team on developing our company's philanthropic endeavors. Together with Ray Ramsey, Biz is a founding director of Converge USA, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit designed to leverage the collective power of several institutions to accelerate positive social change. Along with his wife, Livia, Biz was named a Huffington Post Game Changer for their work and impact in the field of public service. Together, the couple operates the Biz and Livia Stone Foundation, supporting education, conservation in California. Biz is an advisor to several companies and organizations ranging from tiny startups and nonprofits to publicly traded international companies. Biz has been honored with the International Center of Journalism Innovation Award. He holds an honorary doctor of law from Babson College, an honorary board seat at the Wildlife Education and Rehabilitation Center. And he serves on the advisory board of Donors Choose, an online charity that makes it easy for anyone to help teachers and students come together. He's also been named Nerd of the Year by GQ, one of the most influential people in the world by Time Magazine, Entrepreneur of the Decade by Inc. Magazine, and one of Vanity Fair's top 10 most influential people in the information age. But Biz Stone is best known over a decade of developing collaborative web systems freely accessed by hundreds of millions of people. So it really gives me extreme pleasure, and I'm humbled and honored to introduce my fellow social impact advisor and friend, Biz Stone.
Ryan, thanks very much. That was great. That was a wonderful introduction. The last part of it was all lifted from other publications, but that's cool. We don't have a problem with that.
I was Huffington Post.
We would have clicked through. no, actually, it's funny. Don't laugh too much, because I'm actually working with these guys. The reason I'm here is actually because Arianna Huffington was supposed to be here and she canceled. So, thanks for showing up, anyways. before I get started, I just want to really thank Jessica Cox and Hugh Forrest and all the people at South by Southwest who have been working tirelessly since the 80s to make this festival and this event such an incredibly important event, especially for the tech community, especially for us at Twitter, but so many more. I'm sure there's the next great, awesome, wonderful thing that everyone thinks is stupid launching at this event today that will, you know, change the way we live in 2 months. And they've just done an incredible amount for the tech community with Interactive, and I'm sure that they've really made a difference in the city of Austin, despite probably some curmudgeonly longtime residents. But I just applaud their efforts and the amount of work they go to, and they're just, from a speaker perspective, they're an absolute joy to work with. They make everything so easy. So thanks to them, we're able to be here and do all this wonderful stuff, and they make it seem very simple and easy. So I wanted to give them a big thanks for having us here. Yes. South by Southwest. It's awesome. It's really awesome. The things I want to talk about today aren't, I'm not like unveiling the next genius, future, awesome thing, although I'm happy to talk about my own theories on the future of the internet as we get into our discussion parts. I have many ideas and philosophies. What I thought I'd talk about today is just five stories, five personal stories. One of them is the sort of Twitter origin story from my perspective, which, of course, has as a major part of it South by Southwest. And I just love telling this story. I haven't been back to South by Southwest since 2007 when we kind of realized what a big deal it was here, because I didn't want to jinx it. Like, I literally didn't. I love coming to Austin, and I specifically didn't come because I didn't want to jinx it. And now here I am, so I hope I don't jinx it. but I'm doing it for Ariana. Darlings, I'm doing it for Ariana.
Darling.
So the stories. So after I tell you these five stories, which each end in, even though they're personal, and you might be wondering why the hell is Biz telling me this weird story about his childhood, I promise at the end of each story, there's a lesson learned or an aphorism that you can take away that I realized later has a very applicable use to entrepreneurs, to managers, even to students. They're very useful, and I didn't realize until later how useful they were, and I didn't realize at the time what a powerful lesson I was learning. So I hope that you find those lessons learned and those aphorisms useful to you. And if you don't, I hope you at least, you know, get a chuckle out of my personal stories at my expense. So before I actually get started with the stories, I wanted to show you this picture, which was taken literally 30 seconds after I got married. I look like the happiest person in the world, and my wife looks like she just made the biggest mistake of her life. Like, huge mistake. Major, big-time mistake. And that's a real Polaroid. That's not even an Instagram. I mean, look at her body language. It's just crazy. She's just, like, totally upset. Like, what have I done? And I was feeling pretty good about it. So I actually busted out a Ben Franklin quote at the time, which I'll relay to you now, which is, perhaps the history of the errors of mankind, all things considered, is more valuable and interesting than that of their discoveries. So I was trying to tell her, look, Ben Franklin, mistakes can be awesome. They can end up being better than wonderful things. And I think she bought it, because we're still happily married, as far as I know. Okay, so now I want to, and we'll come back. I have a whole story about failure and mistakes and all that stuff. I mean, I have a lot of stories about that, but I'm just going to tell you one, just not to be a downer. So the first story I want to talk about is Twitter, and how it got started, and how it became a big deal when we came here, and then what happened afterwards. So I quit Google and joined up with Evan Williams to build this startup called Odeo, which was a podcasting startup. We thought we were on a car ride home from from Google one day, and I said, wait a minute, you can record your voice in Flash. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, could we convert that to an MP3? And then can't you attach it to an RSS feed? And couldn't you then write a client that just takes the MP3 and like puts it in this new thingamajiggies called iPods? And we could democratize audio just like we were doing with Blogger, but with text? And he was like, oh my God, that's genius. We have to do that. It turns out it was called podcasting and other people were doing it, but but we thought we were geniuses for like, you know, a day, which was a good feeling. And so we decided to raise money and build this company with our friend Noah Glass, and it just didn't work out. For one reason, Apple decided to put podcasting in iTunes, and we were like, ah, that's a good place for it. And for another reason, which I think is actually the bigger reason, we weren't using our product. Like, Evan and I got together over a microphone and we were like, you say something. No, you say something. And not only that, but it turns out that good audio content is highly produced. Like, the good stuff was NPR and stuff. It wasn't a guy in his basement talking about RSS. That was horrible. And you had to kind of listen through it. It was awful. So we very quickly realized, we asked ourselves a question all entrepreneurs should really ask themselves. And Evan actually came up with this great business plan that would have us be the kings of podcasting if we execute it. And then I said to him, once we're the kings of podcasting, is that what we really want to do? Will we be happy? And he was like, no, I don't want to do that. And I was like, well, what are we going to do then? And he was like, good point. So Evan had this great idea, which was, look, we're not supposed to do this because we raised money to build a podcasting service, but there's about 12 of us. Everybody pair up and just work on something that you want to work on that lights a fire for you and is interesting to you. And I had become very good friends with an engineer we hired at Odeo named Jack Dorsey. Jack Dorsey had a history in writing software for,
Pascal.
What's that?
Pascal.
No, he had a history for writing software for like taxi cabs and dispatch software for taxi cabs and ambulances and police cars and all this stuff. And he really loved it because for him it represented the kind of the pulse of a city. Like when he looked at all of his dispatch software, everyone checking in and stuff, he was like, wow, you can sort of see a living, breathing city with the software that I've created. And when we met and I told him that I had started Zanga.com back in 1999, which was a very early social, basically a social blogging community, he said, oh, you have experience with like social stuff. And then at the same time, text messaging was becoming popular in the United States. And in 2004 or 5, the different carriers decided that they would let text messages go between carriers, which was a big deal. And so we got together and we said, look, could we smush this idea of text messaging together with this idea of dispatch and make it somewhat social? And so we got together and we took the 2 weeks that Ev gave us to work on a prototype, and we built the prototype and we shared it with our friends who were also building prototypes. They were building productivity apps and so forth. And we got kind of a ho-hum reception from our colleagues because they were like, it's not very fancy. It's like, shouldn't it do video or something like that? And we were like, no, it's really cool because this text messaging is this rudimentary service and it's really like not really used for very much, but it's this really broad network. It's on every mobile phone, even the lowest common denominator phone. And so we got really excited about it, and so we started working on it. And there was a lot of little key indications early on that were just making me sort of giddy and giggle with it. Like, I remember during the prototype phase, I had watched enough Bob Vila as a kid to think that I could do some home maintenance on this little 400 square foot house my wife and I had bought in Berkeley. I decided to rip up all the rugs to uncover the hardwood floors underneath. There were no hardwood floors underneath. And not only that, there were things underneath there that I don't want to talk about. I'm still scarred. And just for FYI, if you ever want to rip up wall-to-wall carpeting, they nail it down like every millimeter. It's ridiculous. So I was sweating. I was killing myself. I'm hunching over, and my phone vibrates in my pocket. It's an update. It's an early form of a tweet from Ev that says, "Sipping Pinot Noir after a massage in Napa Valley." And so I start laughing out loud. My wife thinks I've gone insane. But I'm laughing out loud, and I'm thinking, you know what? I'm experiencing joy from this thing that we're working on. I am using the product, and I'm delighted by it, and I'm loving it. And a million other little things like that were happening that just kept us working on it, despite the fact that almost everyone we talked to thought it was a really dumb idea. In fact, the biggest critique, the loudest critique of Twitter was, "Twitter is not useful." To which Evan responded, "Well, neither is ice cream. Should we ban ice cream and all joy?" Why are we busting our balls? Why can't we just make this, you know? Enough already, you know? We really just weren't paying attention to all these folks. One person actually had said, "Twitter is like the Seinfeld of the internet. It's a web service about nothing." And I love Seinfeld, so I put that on the front page as like a testimonial. I thought it was great. I also put my phone number on the front page for if you're having any problems, and that became an issue later. But anyways, so we're working along, we're having a lot of fun. You know, all these little things are happening with earthquakes and people checking in, and it's turning out to actually be useful in a lot of little cases and so forth. But then when we came to South by Southwest in 2007, that's when something happened. Something big happened. This is when the proverbial tingles went down our spines. It was a really big deal for us. And the two stories that I remember, and my memory may have made these stories more mythical than they originally were, so just, you know, take them with a grain of salt. But the first story was, I was in an audience like you guys, and I was listening to a panel, and all these people just started getting up, leaving. And it was almost like there was a PA system that had said, "Everybody leave." But there was no PA system. I was like, what is the deal? And I had been going every year, and I'd never seen anything like it. And it turns out people were using Twitter on their mobile phones and their laptops to communicate with each other that there was a much better panel going on across the hall. And so they just all went over there. And when I learned about that, I was like, wow, that's crazy. And then the even more amazing thing that happened was there was a guy at a pub, and I might have this screwed up, but I think it was Scott Beal, or it was either Scott Beal from Laughing Squid, or he told me the story, and I might be totally wrong. But the point is, there was a guy at a pub, and it was really loud. And you guys know the whole point of South by Southwest is not just to see the panels and stuff. It's the party, and it's the network, and it's to meet with the people that you theoretically should meet all the time with in San Francisco and stuff, but you just don't. And so you they're all in one place, and you're seeing them. And so this guy at a pub was like, look, he sent out a tweet that said, this pub, and by this time, by the way, we had like 5,000 people on the system, so... And those 5,000 people were like all the dorks that go to South by South Interactive. So it was like perfect, you know. It was like in the wild for the first time. And so he sent out a tweet saying, this pub's too loud. Let's go to this quieter pub. And he named the pub so we can talk. And in the 8 minutes it took him to walk over to that pub, 800 people had shown up. There was a line out the door. It was totally full. And so his plan absolutely backfired, because what had happened was he had sent out a tweet. Other people retweeted it, forwarded it, whatever. And, like, word got out, and all these people just converged on this place. And when I learned about this, what came to my mind was the concept of a flock of birds moving together in flight around an object. And this is something that looked like a telephone pole or something. And this is something that looks so incredibly choreographed. It's beautiful. It looks like they must have planned this for weeks. And in fact, the mechanics of flocking are very simple. It's rudimentary communication among individuals in real time that allow the many to behave for a few minutes or a few seconds as if they were one. And this happens in nature, but I kind of was overwhelmed because I couldn't think of any tool or service that allowed this power to be in the hands of humans. And yes, we were at a party, but what if it had been something serious? What if it had been a disaster or something else? And that's when the chills were like, oh my God, this could be a powerful new source of communication that could really transform the way we as people can move together and get things done quickly. And I just got really excited about it. And I think it was like, well, 2 days later when we got home to San Francisco, we actually formed Twitter Inc. Like, up to then it was a side project of Obvious Corp, of which we had multiple projects going. But we were like, that's it. We're a company, and this is our thing. And everybody at Obvious Corp, do you want to work here? Yes. Okay. Boom. We're doing it. And it was a really big deal. And then after South by Southwest, we got like a name for ourselves. South by Southwest helped us. We got a lot of press, and we won some awards at South by Southwest. And it was just this, we got the South by Southwest bump. And after that, it seemed like there was an event that happened in the world where we weren't somehow part of the story. And it was just incredible. Like, everything was happening all around the world. And Twitter was just getting mentioned all the time, constantly. And that was helping it just grow more and more. What is this Twitter thing? I mean, there was even an early student-led revolt in Moldova that was organized over Twitter. And I came into work one day, and my inbox was totally full. My email was totally full. My phone inbox. And it was like New York Times and Wall Street Journal, all these really like important publications. They were all asking me the same question. Mr. Stone, what is your involvement in the Moldovan revolts? And I was really tempted to come up with a snarky answer and just say, well, I didn't like what's going on there, so I went over to the wall we have with the different countries and I pressed Moldova. And in reality, I had to say, let me get back to you on that, and I had to go to Wikipedia and look up where the hell Moldova was and what was going on. But it's just an illustration of the fact that there were so many things happening, and we were just becoming part of the story, and it was amazing, and it was incredibly fulfilling, and it made our work seem all the more meaningful, and it just became something that helped rooted the culture of Twitter as a culture of doing good and being proactive and making things happen in the world. And one of the big takeaways, because I worked at Google before that, and Google was a wonderful place to work, and Google was like, technology can solve any problem. And you know, you believed it when you worked there because of the amazing things they were doing. But really the lesson I learned and I took away from Twitter was basically that no matter how sophisticated our machines get, such as this one, no matter how many servers we have, no matter how many crazy, awesome algorithms we design, change is not a triumph of technology. It's a triumph of humanity. And it's people, it's humanity that are going to bring about change in the world and make positive things happen in the world with some help from technology. And that's where we play it. And that's our role. And that's many of our roles here is to be that part of the create the tools that help people do what they do best. And we've long believed that the open exchange of information can lead to a better world. And I've long believed that if you give tools to people that help them do good things, they will exhibit that behavior on a regular basis if they have the right tools. So that's something that Twitter taught me, a lesson, and I think that should that should be a lesson for everyone to take to heart, whatever type of technology you're working on. And remember, it's all about people. So the next story I want to tell you does have to do with a lot of naked dudes running around the field. That's what this is, which is also part of my childhood. But the picture is totally legit. It's from Wikipedia. It's actually a bunch of Native Americans playing a game called lacrosse. So when I was a really little kid, my mom enrolled me in this program called Boy Rangers. It wasn't Boy Scouts or Cub Scouts. It was like this other weird thing that basically died off when I graduated it. And we were modeled after tribes of Native Americans. And I was in the Blackfoot tribe. And actually, the other kids voted me chief of the Blackfoot tribe. And and they gave me the name Owlbear because I was wise like an owl and strong like a bear. And we had to build our own headdress, and we actually had to pay wampum. We had to pay to be in this thing. Like, it was ridiculous. I had to do all these chores at home, and I would get like a quarter, and I had to pay it. And I didn't want to do it. It was a father-son thing, and I didn't have a father, so it was even more miserable for me. And you had to, the idea was you had to advance from papoose to warrior by learning how to, like, tie knots and all this stuff. And, like, I really didn't want to do any of this stuff. So, but I did it anyways. And it took up all my weekends for all my youth and all my friends, or at least my peers, my kids my age, were doing Little League baseball, and they were doing, like, Pee Wee football, and they were playing basketball and doing all this stuff. So when I got to high school, I thought, okay, sports seems like a good way to get involved socially in high school. It seems like a good way to, all my friends were like mathletes and drama nerds and artists and stuff. And I thought, you know, that's great, but I should diversify and I should get into sports. So, and I was pretty naturally athletic. So I started going to these tryouts, and that's when I was just completely dumbstruck because I remember I went to basketball, and I was like, what are all these lines? Oh my God. Like, there's all these lines on the court. Am I supposed to know what these mean? And they were like, okay, Biz, you go. And I was like, no, I don't want to. I'm good. Because I didn't know what line I was supposed to cross and what was what. And they were like, okay, so you're not on the team. You're not doing anything. And then I went to football, and I was like, what's going on here? How many tries do you get? I don't know. I don't want to do it. And so they were like, okay, you're not doing anything. We don't want you on here. And then baseball, forget about it. That was like some kind of religion with the rules. Like, that was freakish. And the kids were already totally into it, and their dads were like yelling, and they knew everything. And I was like, okay, this isn't going to work. So I did some research, and I found that my high school didn't support a certain sport, and that sport was lacrosse. So I went to the administration, and I said, if I can find a coach and enough boys, can I form a lacrosse team? My thinking was, if everyone was clueless, then we would all be as clueless as each other, and I wouldn't have to worry about it. And I guess I could have just learned the rules, but anyways, that didn't occur to me. And the administration was like, yeah, if you can do that, fine. And so I was able to do it. I got a coach. I got a bunch of athletic guys to join the team. And because I removed that layer of insecurity, I was, like, really good at it. And the other guys voted me captain, and I was, like, the high scorer of the team. And I was captain for the 4 years. And we were a good team. We won more than half of our games, and we were really good. And later in life, when I look back upon that, the lesson that I learned from it was that opportunities can be manufactured. Like, we always think about opportunities as, you have to wait for a certain set of circumstances to all come together at the right time, and then you have to know to leap on those. But in fact, you can actually create those set of circumstances yourself, one by one, and then just take them and take the opportunity. And I realized that's what I did, and I realize now that that's actually really good business advice or startup advice or something like this. And so now I try to think about how can I manufacture my own opportunities. And so I think that's that's an aphorism that stuck with me. So after high school, I went to college. I got a scholarship for excellence in the arts. I was an artist, and I went to college, and I didn't like it because in high school I had formed the lacrosse team, I had produced some plays, and I got to college, and I was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. And they were like, whoa, 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 no. You don't tell us here's what we're going to do. We tell you here's what we're going to do. And so it wasn't really working out with me there. But at the same time, I got a side job. And my side job was at Little Brown & Company, which is a publishing company. And they were based at the time on Beacon Hill in Boston, which is where I'm from, Boston. And my job was just schlepping these heavy boxes full of books down from the attic to the lobbies so that they go somewhere else. And this was at a time... like late 90s, middle 90s, when the art department, the department in the book publishing company where they design all the book jackets, the art department was just converting from like spray glue and stat machines and all these old school formats to Macs and desktop publishing. And I had always, since Macs came out, my friend Mark Ginsburg had an early one, and we were always using them, so I had been gradually learning everything about them as we grew up. So I was good at it, and I was good at Photoshop and everything like that. So one day, when the whole art department went out to lunch, I snuck onto the art director's workstation and I found a transmittal, the you know sort of the call for the jacket, and I designed a book jacket, I printed it, I mounted it up, and I slipped it in with the other jackets to go off for approval in New York for sales and editorial approval, and then I went back to moving the boxes. And when the art director came back, he wanted to know who designed this book jacket, and I said me, and he said the box kid, and I said yeah. And then what happened was great. I realize now that it was a mutual benefit because he really didn't have any clue about how to use the computer, but. He said, how'd you like to work here as a book cover designer? And I also realized later that I pissed off all the people that were trying to work their way up to book cover designer. And I'm like 19, and I'm like, all right, I'm the hotshot young book designer, and I get to design books. And I actually won some awards for my books, and which got me even cockier. And I was just like probably a total jerk to all those people. But the point was, what I did was I basically apprenticed with him. And so... on the first day of work, I go into his office. First day of work as an official designer, I go into his office. He calls me in. He doesn't say a word. I'm standing there. I go up to his desk. He reaches behind him without looking. He takes down a book of color swatches. He puts it down. He flips open to like the mocha brown colors. He picks out like sort of a light mocha-y color. He tears it out. He puts it down on his desk, and with one finger, he slides it across, and he says, that's how I take my coffee. And I was like, oh, my God, I dropped out of college for this. This is going to be, oh, my God. And he was like, I'm kidding. I'm joking. And then, actually, later on, I was thinking, that would have been a great test. Like, that would have been a really good test if a designer could go to Dunkin' Donuts and, like, actually get, no, can you put a little more cream? It would have been a really good, like, real-world test of matching a color, but he didn't make me do it. But I did apprentice with him for 2 or 3 years, and you know, my thinking was, like, people graduate college, they can get a job like this. This is, you know, wonderful. And I'll be working with this older guy who's been designing book covers for, like, 20 years, and he'll teach me all these great things. So, and so he did. And I really owe a lot to him because after learning graphic design, I went off on my own, and I taught myself web design to expand my own operation, and that's what got me into... starting Zanga and becoming like a web guy. And so I owe him a lot, and we're still very good friends. And but to get back to the lesson learned from working with him and from working on you know, book jackets and so forth. What I realized while I was working there was this key thing that I hold, like, to my heart forever, which is creativity is a renewable resource. You never run out of creativity. If you do a book jacket and editorial doesn't like it, fine. You can still come up with another awesome book jacket. There's no end to the amount of creativity you can bring. It just doesn't end. Humans are blessed with it. So when you think about it this way, every challenge at work, whatever you're doing, at school, work, managerial, whatever, when you think about creativity as a renewable resource, suddenly every challenge becomes like fun. It becomes like a game. Like, how can I come at this from another creative angle? How can I be more creative about this? And how can I think laterally about this? Like, maybe I don't even need to do it. That's one of my favorite ways of thinking laterally. Like, we need to get this done. And I say, how about we just don't do it? What would happen then? And people are like, oh, actually, yeah, we don't really need to do it at all. I'm like, all right, I'm going home. But seriously, creativity is a renewable resource, and you just got to remember that. Sometimes people get exhausted. You just go out and you look at the ocean, or you look through some design magazines, or you go online and look at some awesome design portfolios, and you know, you'll be restored. It doesn't take much. So the next story I want to tell you is not my story, because I'm afraid of heights, and I would never stand on a bridge like that, and I don't have wings. But this story is a story. This is from a movie directed by Wim Wenders in the 1980s called Wings of Desire. They redid it in like the 90s with Nicolas Cage. Do not bother with that one. Go watch Wings of Desire. And I often recommend this movie to young entrepreneurs, because in this movie, there are these two angels, and their job, no one can see them, and their job is to sort of watch over Berlin, make sure everything's kind of going right. I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, but they can stand next to somebody and listen to their thoughts, and if they're thinking about committing suicide, they kind of like touch them on the shoulder, and then suddenly they're like, well, maybe things aren't so bad. And so they sort of keep reality in check, right? But one of these two angels falls in love with this circus trapeze artist. It's a bit of an art film, if you haven't guessed by now. And he really starts longing for what it would feel like to hold a hot cup of coffee in his hands, or kiss a woman, or eat food, or do all these things that he can't do as an immortal angel being. And so he goes to his buddy angel and he says, listen, I'm thinking of renouncing my immortal status and just falling to earth as a regular man. And he's like, are you crazy? You'll become mortal and you'll eventually die. And he's like, I know, but I really want to live. I want to do these things. And his guy's like, all right, you're crazy, but go ahead. So he does it and he falls to earth. He also falls to earth with some like gold angelic armor, which he pawns and gets a suit. I think they just wrote that in so he could get a suit so he wouldn't be naked. Anyways,
sure.
That doesn't really matter. The point is, he gave up his immortality, and he eventually did meet up with this woman that he had fallen in love with, and they like met towards the end of the movie. They like lock eyes in a bar. It's as if they've known each other forever, and so it ends happily. But the lesson from that film is totally applicable to so many startups who are like hedging, like, well, we get the startup, but we do a little consulting stuff on the side because, you know, that gets us to pay for it and stuff, and that way we don't have to go and raise money and all that jazz. And to them I say, watch this movie and realize that to succeed spectacularly, you need to be willing to fail spectacularly. Like, it's the equivalent. Like, if you want to really be successful, you need to be willing to be as equally unsuccessful and totally embarrassed and basically die. Like, I mean, I don't advocate dying, but you got to put it all on the line is essentially the lesson that this film well illustrates. And you'd be surprised how many people are like, right on, I do have to do that because I've been hedging. And so it's really a powerful message that I, even to this day, have to remind myself, like, you know what? I'm hedging. I got to go for it. I got to do the real deal. So The next story I want to tell you about has to do with empathy and the importance of it. When I was a young man, and I always thought, you know, you were a good person if someone was collecting money to help fight poverty and you put $2 in their can, and, you know, that's what you were supposed to do. But you had no expectation of any kind of measured result, or like a letter 2 months later that says, "Biz, thank you so much for the $2 last month. Poverty's over." You know, like, we did it, you know. And so I always felt like it was just something you were supposed to do. It was kind of a black hole, and it was just what good people did. But several years ago, I started working with the folks at Product Red, and they blew my mind because they told me about this thing called the Lazarus effect. And what this is, a lot of you have probably heard about it, but what it is you give these two retroviral pills to a person who has HIV/AIDS. They're 40 cents. You give them to them every day for 30 to 90 days, and the transformation is unbelievable. A person goes from looking like they are at death's door to becoming a totally robust and healthy person who doesn't transmit the disease, can go back to work, can go back to being a mom, can go back to being a teacher, can go back to school, can do all these things. This picture, by the way, is the same kid after like 30 days. It's just absolutely amazing. Mm. And what happens, the thing that blew my mind is that as they work, as they help these different groups of people in these different areas, and people go back to work, and they go back to school, and they go back to being teachers and so forth, that entire geoeconomic region stabilizes. And then they move on to another one, and they do the same thing, and that geoeconomic region stabilizes. And so now we have what I was joking about before. We have measured results. We have actual, real impact. And the takeaway for me from that was that there's a compound interest in altruism. There's a lot of flawed thinking about how you should do good in the world. A lot of people think that they should wait until they're comfortably rich or they have billions of dollars and then throw some money at a problem. But you don't have to be. You can get involved. The earlier you get involved, the more impact you'll have over time. That's the beauty of this compound interest. It's just like a compound interest bank account. Like, put a little bit in, over the years, it'll be this massive amount of money. And the same thing is true with helping out. And I always tell, especially people who are like job hunting, and, you know, job hunting is horrible, and you go and you get 8 months in a row, you're rejected every day. Go volunteer somewhere. You'll feel great about yourself. You'll be working with other people who have jobs, so you'll be networking, and they might want to hire you because they're seeing you in this environment where you're working hard, and it gives you and fills you with confidence, and it's so much better than this daily rejection. And not only that, you really are helping out. And I also think this idea of unlocking your empathy and thinking about altruism earlier rather than later has a big role to play in companies, especially startups, because startups have the opportunity to make this part of their culture. I mean, Twitter, for example, had a corporate social responsibility person years before we ever hired a salesperson. And a culture is going to emerge from your company, whether you like it or not. The phenomenon of the whole becoming something greater than the sum of its parts is just a natural phenomenon, and it happens. And you might get lucky in that your culture turns out to be good without any work, but because of human nature and fear and not knowing some other people and so forth, the chances of that happening are low. So if you pay attention to your culture early and weave causes and meaning into what you're doing, you'll have a strong, powerful culture, but you'll also notice that you're attracting really, really high quality talent, like engineers in Silicon Valley who could work anywhere they want because they're so talented. They can ask for as much money as they want. They can work anywhere they want. But they want to work somewhere where they know that they're going to be participating in something meaningful. Or customers. Customers want to know, you know, if there's two choices of sugar water and one of them is really helping out some cause. Like, I've long thought Coca-Cola, with their drive into emerging nations, they have this incredible, they have all these roads and all these ways into emerging nations. I always thought their marketing plan should just be work with the World Food Program to put the red cups, which is what the World Food Program has, put those on the trucks and be known as the guys with the red trucks that give away the free food that make your kids succeed. That's how great of a marketing plan is that? And I think the future of marketing is philanthropy, because I think in the future people will, if they have a $5 million marketing budget, they'll spend $4 million on a cause, and then they'll spend $1 million making a whole big deal about how they helped out this cause. So you don't even have to be naturally empathetic or altruistic in order to realize that this is going to actually help your business. So weaving, doing good by doing well by doing good into your business, big or small, is a really key thing. And this is something that Brian and I are really working on and talking about and investigating and seeing how we can make this part of the future, not just because it's a good thing to do, but because it actually has to be true. In order for the world and human civilization to succeed, this must be true. So basically, to wind things up, in conclusion, I encourage everyone to create your own opportunities. I encourage everyone to be infinitely creative. I encourage you to embrace failure with all your hearts. I encourage you to ask questions of older folks, of folks who are in different fields. You know, if you have the chance to apprentice, do it. Ask questions. With Steve Snyder, I asked him, you know, when did you know it was the right time to propose to your wife? How much money did you ask for your first job? He's like, why are you asking me this? We're doing design. I'm like, because you're older and you know. So ask questions. And really take time to walk in another person's shoes and develop this empathy and develop this strong regard for how other people are feeling. And I think if we all are thinking along those lines, I think we have the opportunity to totally transform the definition of capitalism as we know it today to have these three elements. We can change the world, we can build a business and make money, and we can have fun doing it. And I think this is the new success metric for capitalism. And you can't just have two of these things, you have to have all three to be successful. And that's what I'm on a sort of a mission to do. And just before we get into the talks, I wanted to quickly show you. My son can now do tummy time. He's 3.5 months old. Jacob Arthur Stone. I figured, why not? I have thousands of people. Why not show a picture of my baby?
It's a beautiful baby.
Right? So thanks. Thanks for all your time. And now we'll get into
I think
the
Q&A. We have
Q&A.
Time for what? Well, how many questions?
Did I run over?
Just a touch.
Sorry.
It's okay. Can we just start questions on that mic over there? But we don't have. We'll try to move as quickly as possible. If anybody has any questions,
I think we're out of time for questions.
We're out of time for questions. Well, if you could show, so how about this?
But we have one more thing.
We have one more thing we want to announce to people. Can we get the slide, sir?
Slide people. Can we show the
slide people in the back? Give you that instant.
This is the thing that Brian and I are working together that we want to announce. So
there we go.
You go.
Okay, so we are going to be launching a video series where Biz will be interviewing different luminaries, CEOs, and people that are engaging around new models and how companies, large and small, will be in the process of giving back and how it impacts their DNA, how they operate as a business, how it engages their own volunteers, and also why they're doing this, and how today it's no longer a choice or them just writing a check, but that they have to be participating in this model in order to succeed. And Biz is going to be interviewing right now.
Brian's got some incredible, like, inaccessible genius people lined up. And there's an email here. So if as a special treat to folks at this session, we created this email address. So if you want me to ask any of these guys a particular question, we'll try to work it in, and I'll try to like say, you know, so-and-so from Austin or wherever wanted to know this, and so it'll be in the series, and it'll be kind of fun. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to talking to these guys. They're geniuses.
So email impact@huffingtonpost.com and just put in the byline South by Southwest and ask the question of Verbiz to ask, and we'll actually ask that, and we'll give you credit for it too. So listen, thank you everybody for coming.
Thanks
we really
so much
appreciate
for your
it.
Time.
Thanks so much.